on all their other flights. Originally, Doc and I had, one thrust level, and then they went to the Falcon 9 1.1 version, and now they're calling this the Falcon 9 full thrust version. So it's bigger tanks, more power out of the engine, out of the Merlin 1B engine. And interesting, I will be following this one because this time they plan on bringing the booster back. Falcon 9 is boosters now only going to come back from from space and try to land on a autonomous barge like they've been doing. This one's a little different. They're going to bring this right back to Florida, and they're going to forget about the barge for now. And they rebuilt the launch complex down in Florida, on Merritt Island, in Cape Canaveral. Used to be called Launch Complex 13, and it's been inactive for 10, 20 years. So they took it over and rebuilt it, and they're making a landing pad out of it. So this booster is going to do a boost back all the way to Florida, and I wouldn't be surprised if they nail this one. They're hoping they can duplicate what Blue Origin did last month with their new Shepard spacecraft that went suborbital, and they successfully saved their booster by landing it vertically. This will be a vertical landing as well, except this is a much bigger engine, much bigger rocket. It's putting a spacecraft into orbit and bringing that first stage back is a much more difficult level than what Blue Origin did. We'll see how they do. It'll look forward to December 15th. Back to you, Dick.
So it's going to be launching things into orbit at 400 miles, if I understand correctly, 11 birds, and then it's going to deorbit and come back. Now, for a booster to deorbit, you retrofire your engines, you come down to a low enough altitude, you start hitting the atmosphere. In the case of a booster, I'm having trouble picturing the fact that it can take off from the land, launch objects into space. Somewhere on it there's a heat shield for the way it gets rid of energy during the time it re-enters the atmosphere. It survives that re-entry, then uses its rocket engines to land on Florida at Launch Complex 13. What does that ablative heat shield material that hits the atmosphere, what does that material look like, and how do you mount that on a booster, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, no, you're about 5 years into the future. That would be for the second stage. I didn't make myself clear. Falcon 9 is a two-stage rocket, so we're talking about the original first stage, one that launches the whole rocket from, in this case, Launch Complex 40. That's where they take off. pad. So that's the deal. They've done this a couple of times before. Two times before, they almost landed on a barge doing the exact same thing. The difference here is they plan on landing on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, thanks. I probably missed that. Dick, did I miss anything?
Yeah, you and I own the Space Shuttle Operator's Handbook. And in the very early stages of the launch from the ground of the Space Shuttle, there are a couple of places where it could do a return to base. And so this thing is doing a launching of something up to a pretty darn high altitude, so that now the second stage goes into space, and then it does a return to base. That's an interesting amount of energy. They're not making another orbit around the Earth, so this is a suborbital first stage booster return to base. And if they tried to land it on a barge in the water in the past and didn't quite do it, now they're going to land it over land of Florida, which implies they're coming relatively close to habitable areas. So it sounds like there's a bit of a leap of faith here as to the safety of this mission, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I'm sure the FAA looked at that past record, and in the last probably four flights that they tried this, two of them, they had the barge ready, you know, it was planned to land on a barge, and then the other two, there was bad weather, and they just wanted to land close to the barge, and, well, actually, one flight was without a barge, and they just wanted to see how it was going to come down and land in the water, but every time, all four times, they were right on the money. In fact, the two times that they planned on landing on the barge, they hit the barge dead center. I mean, they were right on the money. The only problem is the booster was coming down at a bit of an angle. One time that they had hydraulic problems. They ran out of hydraulic fluid. The other time, another, you know, these little minor problems that they actually might have fixed. And what they believe they have fixed. So when they hit the barge, one time it tipped over and then it blew up. You know, the other time it came down at a bit of an angle, blew up. So that's the deal. The second stage won't be coming back. Probably this will be like maybe 5 years down the road. I mean, his goal is to eventually bring almost 99% of everything back, you know. Right as it is, he's bringing the spacecraft back on every flight. But this, you know, the first goal is to bring the main booster back. And as years go by, he's thinking about eventually having a heat shield and, you know, this whole system of bringing the second stage back. But, that, you know, that's not in the cards yet.
Recently, the International Space Station had six people on board, if I understand correctly. Three of them just came back this week on the Soyuz in the dark in a snowstorm. Now there's three people on the ISS. There's going to be three there for roughly how long? When will the next launch of more people on the ISS take place, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, right around the same time, and that the Falcon 9 is going to be taking off. Falcon 9 is planned for the middle of the month, but I think it's going to slip to the end of the month. So, but the manned missions from Russia, you know, from Kazakhstan on the Soyuz spacecraft will take place on the 15th, and they're pretty good out there. I mean, there aren't too many days that they say they're going to go and that they don't go. So I'm going to say the 15th of this month, they'll probably the short version. You know, there's a 2-day version and then there's a 6-hour version. I think they're going to do the 6-hour version of getting up to the space station this time. And after that, they'll have six people on board. And once, like I said, output, just science output, is what, even so it's only one extra guy, don't have twice the amount of science that could be done on the space station once that happens.
There's an American astronaut, I've forgotten his name, you're going to tell me, who's going to spend, I think it's a full year, or is it 6 months, but I think it's a full year on the ISS. How much time has he accumulated, and how soon is he due to come back, Paul? Go ahead.
They have two people doing it. Koryatko is the Russian guy, and he went up at the same time as Scott Kelly. Scott Kelly and him and another guy went up on in March. So next March they'll be coming back. And it's actually just short of a year. I think it's just over 11 months. But you never know the way things play out. If there's problems here and there or whatever, you know, they might find themselves another month or two up there. That's what happened to the last group. Not the ones that came back this time, but the ones before that. Two guys and one girl are from European Space Agency. Man, there was Chris and Eddie. They wound up spending an extra 2.5 months on board the space station. So you never know. But let me drop it. Scott Kelly is the one with the twin brother. Both are astronauts. Both have been to the space station before. So his brother, Mark, is now out of NASA, but going along with tests on the ground, trying to do an A-B type of test because they're identical twins, trying to test out the difference between biological systems compared to being in microgravity and on Earth. Mark is also the one that was married to Gabby, or is married to Gabby, and she's the congresswoman that shot in Arizona a few years back. That's the story on those people. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, is there anyone who has any further questions for Paul on the subject of space? Give us your call letters right now. T2RIW.
WGB with a quick one.
You've got it, John.
Dick, maybe you know, or Paul, maybe you know. With this first stage that's going to come back, I think you said approximately a 300-mile trip, how does that work out aerodynamically? Does it have extendable fins on it or something that allows it to be guided a little bit easier, or is it all rocket power that's going to be controlling that descent? Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to guess it's all rocket power. Let's find out, Paul. How is it coming back? I don't think it can suddenly spout wings, but that would be nice if it could. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, it's actually both. Like I said before, it's three times that the rockets reignite, not counting the original time when they launch up Launch Complex 40. Three times they use their rocket power to boost back to the to Launch Complex 1, they're calling it. And by the way, the extra fuel on board, talked about this I think a couple of weeks ago, is being done with cryogenics. Oxygen, of course, liquid oxygen, that's cryogenically cool, but the RP-1 or rocket propellant 1, or, you know, it's an upgraded kerosene, is also being cooled down to the point where you can get a lot more fuel. They call it densification, and they can get more fuel on board to do that. And that's the reason they can do this, and in the future, Falcon 9 rockets, when they launch spacecraft to geosynchronous orbit, in the past they weren't able to do that. They just dumped the rocket. They let it. It was expendable. It wound up going into the ocean. But now, even those with this extra fuel on board. that. You know, and these barges, eventually in the future, will be used also, even if they bring them back on a regular basis to land in the future. When you have the Falcon 9 going up, you can have two boosters coming all the way back to land, and then the third one will be way too far out over the ocean, too far to bring back to land. That'll just boost back and land on the barge out in the middle of the ocean again. So that's the plan. But they do have an aerodynamic situation going on. When it's coming back down through the atmosphere, the second it picks up atmosphere, like I said, it starts off, you know, 60, 70 miles high, and it's very rarefied up there. There's practically no air. But when it starts getting down a little bit low, it picks up some air. And to control the descent on the way down, dropping these big flaps or wings, or you want to call them, very short wings, but four of them that pop out of the sides of the booster, and they look like gigantic square tennis rackets, and they articulate. They could open all the way out to 90 degrees perpendicular, or they could shorten up, or they could roll by pitching one way or the other as it's coming down. That's controlling its descent of where it's going, and because of all the GPS, whatever they have on board to bring it back to the proper landing spot, that brings it back, you know, where they want to be. Now, that's all controlled by hydraulics. Let me drop it. And the hydraulic system, the fuel that they're using is actually the RP-1. It's the pumps, pumping fuel through the, to the Merlin 1D engine, at the bottom of the Falcon 9 rocket. But, you know, they have a takeoff port that goes up to the hydraulics of these four things that are moving around at the top of the booster. In fact, that's why I mentioned earlier that one of the problems that they had, they ran out of hydraulic fuel to do that. It's an open system. It's not a closed hydraulic system, so it doesn't, go around and around. If they run out of fuel, go to the hydraulics, they run out. But they managed to fix that problem last time, so they won't have that problem this time as well. So that's how they control it. Now, it's interesting. I saw this one other time years ago. I wonder if Elon Musk got this idea from something I saw many years ago. During the war, Iraq, they were testing this bomb that they wanted to use, and it was going to blow up over the south coast of Florida. They were going to drop it out of an airplane and had a parachute and everything on board. And then they let it go, and it was free falling. And this thing had these same things, these same looking things. I don't know if they moved around or anything, but they came out to point this bomb in the right direction. And this bomb was called a Mohab, a mother of all bombs or something. And it was, one of these big bombs that went off. It was supposed to be like the equivalent to a nuclear blast without the radiation. But that thing, if you ever look at the pictures of that in close up, it has a similar setup that Elon Musk put on the top of the Falcon 9. I wonder if he got that idea from that thing. Back to you, Dick, or John. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Hey, you've given me a very different picture just now, Paul. I think you're saying the booster gets up to 63 miles altitude. I'm guessing it's moving something like 10,000 miles an hour. And in order for you to take the speed forward...
Oh, 4,000.
What was that again, Paul? 4,000, did you say?
4,000 when they... that's how fast that booster is going at the time.
But it's going 4,000 from west toward east. In order to come back to even further to now go, let me pick a number, 5,000 miles an hour in the other direction. That's a lot of boosting. If instead you just finish the boosting, you wait till you come back down, because it's a suborbital flight as far as the booster is concerned, you come back down to the atmosphere, and with wings, you allow the wings to make a 180-degree turn. That's a hell of a lot more efficient than trying to do that with all rocket power. So I'm guessing that the 180-degree turn in order to fly back to Cape Canaveral, Kennedy Space Center, from 63-mile altitude, by the time you hit the atmosphere, you're a hell of a lot lower, but still, you're probably 80,000 miles up. You can, you're almost at the point where you could, with those wings, glide back to the space center. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, from what I saw, the, you know, those little wings don't pop open until you vertically coming down, you know. So that means that whole trip back, how far it is, a couple hundred miles, I guess. You know, they have to go west. But the boost back, you know, that boost back is, you know, it's, like I said, it's going, you know, parallel to when you, when it separates from the second stage and the payload. Then these little nitrogen rockets come on and turns it around and 180 degrees. And these, I believe there's three rockets that go off out of the nine. And that pushes them, it slows their descent, you know, the rate down from 4,000 miles an hour down to, I guess, the equivalent to zero, because it's got to go backwards, you know. And then, sure, it's dropping the whole time as this is going on. Then it turns vertically, and then as it's coming down vertically, these flaps open up at the top, and they're not solid wings either. They look like there's holes going through them. It's almost like a tennis racket. I guess if they were solid, they'd probably break off as they open them. I don't know. So they slow down even more, and especially when they get down to, I think, 300 miles an hour or something, their rocket comes on, you know, a second time to slow its descent, shuts off, right, it looks like lift, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds from what I remember seeing on the video, that then it comes on again, drop it. And then, you know, you can actually see that rock at the bottom, you know, the, it's, being gimbaled, you know, you can see that the flame is actually pointing one way or the other way wildly. I think that was the, one of the other problems that they had, that one of the valves on that thing wasn't working right, so I'm sure they straightened all that out. And, you know, that makes that actuate like that. And then also at the top, you can see the nitrogen jets firing at the top, you know, they're shooting out of the top, you know, perpendicularly to the length of the rocket, you know, trying to keep this thing straight. Amazing. And I don't know, that's pretty much it. I just wanted also, before I forget, I got to thank Rich. I know he's out there listening, K2UPS, for that email. Give me nice pictures or website to look at the moon, all the different power landings that you could actually see with LRO, the orbit going around the moon all the time now. Had to mention that. Back to you, Dick. WS2F.
Yeah, I want also thank Rich KTUBS for sending that those videos to us. That website. Did you notice, Paul, that each one of the landing sites, the lunar module, has a ring of black dirt around the lunar module? I wonder if that's because they enhanced a photograph in that region, or do you think the process of the retro rocket of the landing stirred up the dirt and made it that black? Got a guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I thought it was just a shadow from the descent module. Just saying, further out from the descent module. I'll have to look at that again. I got a big kick out of the Surveyor 3. I wanted to see that. The relationship to how far they had to walk on Apollo 12 to get to that. That was pretty cool. You know, that, the Surveyor 3 was, you know, we had a lot of surveyors landing on the moon, and they wanted to see how close they could land to that thing. And then they didn't. They walked in. They didn't have a rover on 12, so that was pretty cool. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. In the case of 12, I think that's the one where the camera looked at the sun, and therefore they lost an awful lot of live pictures during the mission. And Apollo 14, I think, first had the lunar rover car. You'll notice that a number of the missions, when you look at the trails between the lunar module and the ALSA package, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package, you see a bunch of trails where they went off to one side, what looks like 50 yards, and actually mounted that thing in the ground. And as you know, our happy little group of guys during Apollo 15 and 16, during Apollo 16, we managed to listen to the signal from Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package. I think that was on 2280 megahertz, I think it was on. And we had a phase lock loop receiver that could go to all those frequencies, and we actually listened to that. I think it's roughly a 1-watt transmitter on the outset packages. But the black ring around each lunar module looks like it's about twice the diameter of the lunar module. So they've either enhanced the photograph in that region, but if they enhanced it, it wouldn't be black like that, I don't think. So I'm not sure on this one. I know that we're all being fooled by the lunar soil really is a black coal dust. In other words, if you chopped up coal into a fine dust, that's approximately what the material of the lunar surface would look like when it's smeared across the... Let me drop... When it's smeared across the knees of the astronaut's uniform, you can easily see how black the stuff is. We get fooled by the photography on the moon because you've got a whole lot of bright objects at high noon. You've got the lunar module itself with its reflective foil on it, the astronauts, their white suits. You got a lot of bright stuff. And when the camera is adjusted for that environment, the soil looks like it's light in color. But I suspect it's really as black as coal dust. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't know. They call it Regulus. I know that. But, and I know when Armstrong and Aldrin came back into the command module, you know, Collins told me not coming in here like that. Mess up my command module, you know. Dust all that stuff off back at the LEM, you know. They smell like gunpowder or something. It's got a funny smell to it. But the dust is all over. That's probably what it is, you know. Maybe a reaction from the... probably from the descent module. I don't think it would be from the ascent module, you know. That took off. I don't think that would do much. Although the blast of the ascent module, I can see knocked over one of the flags. I don't think it would leave that big ring like that. Probably the descent module. And you can see the rovers up there. Amazing. LRO is a very good spacecraft. I'm glad they put that into orbit. Probably learned quite a bit. You know, the photography, of course, has changed so much over the decades by having the LRO mission. I think it's going to really help, especially when they start going back to the moon. They're starting with, I think private companies are going to be doing that very shortly. You'll see that in a couple of years as well. Sending unmanned rockets to the, or landers to the moon. Should be interesting. At least they'll have a good photographs of what they're doing when they do it. Back to you, Dick.
Compared to the previous pictures, these pictures are much, much higher in resolution. Do you have a rough guess at what altitude the LRO was above that surface when it took those pictures, Paul? Go ahead.
I thought they went down to 30 miles. Standard altitude for, you know, all the command modules, you know, over the years have been around 60 miles up. And, you know, that was where they hung out. But they've gone in lower. The surveillance pictures on some of the satellites that have gone up, including there was a Pathfinder that went up. No, not Pathfinder, Prospector. It was the name of the Prospector years ago. And they went in low, I think, 9 miles or something. I'm not sure the present altitude of LRO, though. I don't know.
Do you know the approximate velocity of the LRO in orbit around the moon? Is it in the vicinity of 10,000 miles an hour or so?
I thought they were all around 4,000, 5,000. Let's see. I got to do the math in my head. Oh, wait, that's what we had you for, Dick. It takes roughly, what, an hour and 20 minutes or so, roughly an hour and a half. I think it's less than what we usually do for our orbits for the space station. Our orbit for the space station on Earth is roughly an hour and a half, 90 minutes, 91 minutes. I think the moon is close to the same. So you take the diameter of the moon, you know, or the circumference of the moon, and do the math. I think I'm going to guess it was around a little over 4,000 miles an hour, as I recall.
I think you said the orbital period is something like 90 minutes around the moon, so we can figure it from that. And so, in order for those photographs not to have any blur, that camera has to be slewing while it makes that photo. Otherwise, you'd be getting some streaks in the photograph. So, that's a well-timed photograph to get that kind of resolution. A good-sized lens, possibly a 30-mile altitude, and something like 4,000 or 5,000 miles an hour velocity of the vehicle. Good photography. Have to study those a little bit more. Okay. One last question, one last time. Anybody else got any further questions for Paul before we leave the space program portion of the TechNet? K2RIW listening. Okay, now we'll go over to, Rich, Jonathan, possibly Roger, and Joe, W2RYY. Rich, 2EO, I know that you had a question for the TechNet today. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO, yes. It's more a request than a question, if that's okay, and I think it is. I need somebody who is a ham radio operator that is experienced, and also the same person being a experienced carpenter. And odd combination, but not impossible. The reason is I want to put up a brand new ham radio operating combination computer table. What I have here now is put together furniture that's fallen apart. It's made out of that composition board. And as you know, Dick, I think most people know, but I can't do it anymore. I used to do these things when I lived in Queens. I mean, it'll be set. You know, I'm currently, and forever, I'm confined to a wheelchair. I'm an amputee. I need somebody, a ham, who could disassemble the ham station, build the table, preferably a 4-micah table, put it up, and hook up the ham gear. So that's the request again to be up.
Make a guess, Rich, roughly what size table do you think you require for your ham equipment?
Guess 5 feet by 5 feet, roughly. I didn't measure, but I can tell you what I have. I'm really crammed in. It's a small room. So if anybody knows, I would appreciate knowing who it is and if they can get in touch with me or I can get in touch with them.
here. What's the easiest way for them to get a hold of you, Rich? N2EO. I seem to remember that was the main portion of your website. Is that true? Your email address?
Okay, Dick. By the way, I'm not looking for a volunteer. It's a lot of work. I want to pay somebody. What do they say? Gotta pay to pay, pay to play? I'm willing to pay for it. I'll have the money by the end of March when I take money out of my reverse mortgage. So I don't mind paying whatever. I just want a good deal at a fair price. That's all I ask. They can get in touch with me either at N2EO at optinonline.net, or they can get Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E, underscore, N2EO at yahoo.com. Can I give up my phone number, Dick?
Your choice. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Dick. 631-855-6425. And for anybody listening that can do the job, I'm located at the Massapequa Park, right across the street from Massapequa High School. Back to net and to you.
Okay. So, you need that in the vicinity of March. Approximately 3 months from now is when you can afford this, if I understand correctly here, Rich. Good luck with that project. The next person was Jonathan, KC2SHO. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Jonathan, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Roger, K2JIS, did you have a further question or comment? K2JIS, K2RIW in the TechNet. Joe, WA2RYY, you're the next person on the list. Go right ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, WA2RYY. My question is, have you ever heard of a thing called Project hyphen Emerald? There was a clip in the news on December 9th on CBS News, I think it was in the morning, about this, and apparently it's some people at MIT that are using Wi-Fi frequencies. I don't know if they said it's a Wi-Fi system, but it sounds like they're saying they're using frequency in the Wi-Fi system in advance. That's about 10,000 times less powerful than Wi-Fi, and they're able to be able to use this technology with special algorithms, multiple algorithms, and you're able to detect objects in a room moving and so forth, and even if the object is laying down, and they claim they can also, if it's a human being, get some parameters from the person, like heartbeat, things like that. My question is, do you think they can get the accuracy of something like this because on that particular wavelength? I thought you had to use a much, much higher wavelength to get the precision as far as like a radar type of imaging or something like that, back through seeing something through a wall. Back to you, Dick.
Here, I don't really know, Joe, but I'm going to make a couple of guesses. For some period of time, people have been studying the RF equivalent of holography. So that if I've got a system that can radiate signals, if I've got the right kind of a phased array that can receive the signals, and if I can receive the signals in such a way that I'm measuring not only pattern, but phase angle of reflection, I can now do a kind of three-dimensional reconstruction of what out there is giving me that radio reflection. I call it RF holography. You know what a hologram looks like? It really is a bunch of call it multiple-layer photographic material, and depending on the positions of the individual dots of material throughout this rather thick film, you can set it up in such a way that coherent light source at the right angle aimed at this hologram will give what the human eye sees as a three-dimensional object, the pair of human eyes. Your computer vision will see a three-dimensional object, and you can even take the photograph and almost walk around the back side of it, so to speak. So I think there's an RF equivalent of that, Joe. Pure guess on my part. I've seen various articles of where people are attempting to do something along those lines. And there was, in the last week, let me drop this. One of the websites that I get a weekly report from, I think it's Electronic Design News, they showed pictures taken through a wall of a human being on the other side with RF energy. And it's a rather low resolution picture, but if you know what you're looking at, you do recognize the characteristics of a human on the other side. This is also kind of close to what we're talking about. But that project itself, no, I haven't heard about it, Paul. John. Here we go, Joe. WHYY, drag your feet in case somebody else knows about it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, Joe. Dick.
Tell us what you know on the subject, John. Or any subject.
Well, I'm limited in that, but Joe had sent me a copy of that, I think it was a YouTube video of CBS demonstrating this article from MIT, this item. And apparently, with the Wi-Fi radiation, they have a screen that they're looking at. And that screen depicts the room with, I believe, drawn-in images of, like, the chairs and the locations of maybe the TV set in the room. But the human that's walking around in the room is shown as a dot. You can tell exactly where they're standing. You don't see a human shape. All you see is this dot. But if his elevation changes, so he passes out, falls to the floor, it goes to a mode of reading his medical data the same way. How it does that, I don't know. They didn't really explain too much, but that's what I saw in the video when I watched it real quick before the net. Maybe Joe could send you that email. You could take a look at it. You might be able to bring a little more resolution in what your thoughts are. KC2WGB.
That sounded like fun. I saw a very gentle hint of this way back in 1971. You can see a picture of what I was using by looking at the June issue, 1972 QST magazine, and also the August issue. June issue is the article called Houston, This is Apollo, and the August issue is the picture of the 12-foot dish. As I was standing on a wooden chair in front of that dish, holding onto the feed horn in order to readjust its position, while a very sensitive radiometer receiver was connected to that feed horn, the presence of me in front of the dish was causing RF energy to be emitted by my body at 2.3 gigahertz, because my body is warmer than cold sky. The dish was aimed up in the air at about a 30-degree angle, and I'm standing on a chair in front of the dish adjusting the horn. And as I climbed up on the chair, I could see the needle on the radiometer move up the scale a whole lot because of the heat of my body radiating energy at 2.3 gigs. Everything above absolute zero radiates a radio signal. And when the dish is aimed at blue sky, which is nice and cold, radio-wise, and I'm at, 290? No, I'm more than that. I'm 300 degrees Kelvin, something like that. I'm a hot object as far as a very sensitive radio receiver is concerned. Everything above absolute zero radiates a noisy radio signal. And so I realized then that I had the ability, let me drop. I had the ability to aim that dish through a sheetrock wall, and I could tell you whether or not there was a human being on the other side of the wall, because a human being is considerably warmer than any other object in the room. And also, a human being is mostly made out of water. Water is an extremely absorptive material at 2.3 gigs. And the absorptivity-emissivity ratio, what that really means is that anything that will absorb radio waves very well is simultaneously a very good emitter of radio waves. So a human being containing water, which is so absorptive, is an extremely efficient radiator, whereas everything else in the room is dry. And regardless of the temperature of the things in the room, they're not going to radiate signals anywhere near as much as a human being. So I could, with that system, easily detect a human being on the other side of a wall. Tell us what you remember seeing from this YouTube video, Joe. Sounds like a fascinating project. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I didn't watch the video. I just sent the link over to John so he could email it to you, so you could watch the video directly.
Okay. I'm reasonably sure that QRZ.com with my call letters indicates my email address. So there's no secret there. my call letters at aroil.net is an easy way to send things to me. So you didn't have to go the roundabout way if you didn't want to. But maybe you were saving me some time because I did have a couple of things to do before I could start the net tonight. And would I have had time to look at that email, I'm not sure.
I'll get it over to you, though, Dick. I will send it to you.
Sounds good. Sounds like you gave it a quick look, and I guess you've already described what you saw. Joe didn't look at it yet. How did you come upon this YouTube video, Joe? Go ahead.
I don't know why the crazy tone changed. By the way, you're Duplex, so you hear that noise behind you. Is that the noise you talked about and I talked about together one time that you're hearing intermittently from time to time? Is that what you're hearing?
That's a good question, Joe. I'm hearing those bursts of noise. I don't know what's causing it tonight. I'm guessing it could have something to do with the switching network that does the voting, system. I am guessing it could be voting related. And for all we know, one of the receivers occasionally experiences a loud burst of local noise. It's a pure guess on my part. Over to you, Joe. I just heard a burst right then, for instance. You got it, Joe.
Okay, let me ask this. Can I ask KE2EJ to go on there and shut the other local inputs off, or the other inputs off, and run just the one main receiver? Can you do that if that's possible? Just a hunch.
I'm not sure whether or not Eric is with us tonight. Right now at this time. He doesn't always have the freedom of listening to the whole TechNet. It's a long, drawn-out thing. But I'm not hearing any burst of noise right now. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, well, no, I didn't want to answer your question directly. No, I didn't watch the video, the YouTube video, but I watched the presentation on the news program in the morning. It was on CBS, CBS morning show between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock. That's when I saw this thing, and I looked for it a few days later on the internet, and I found the specific link to it, talking about. I never heard about it before, so I figured, well, might be an interesting thing you'd like to talk about, if you do something about it, because it's kind of, interesting to be able to take radio waves, run through a wall, and kind of get a reflection and see what's coming back from the other side, especially like when they said, if the human being falls down, they can start taking readings of the human being to determine breathing rate, possibly heartbeat, things like that. It's got some fantastic possibilities that they can really do that.
Yeah, the sophistication of the hardware that can do that is pretty high. We're talking about imaging here, and when it comes to TSA investigations, you'd like to be able to see through the person's sweater to know whether or not there are opaque objects being hidden in his clothing when you're doing a TSA investigation. And some of that is being done in a radiometry manner, passive manner, sometimes active manner, at 94 gigahertz. And the reason they chose 94 gigahertz is that it's a high enough frequency, small enough wavelength, where a focal plane array of, let's say, dipoles can allow you to do imaging. And I know some of the people who have been involved in those kind of projects. And they're kind of exciting. This thing that you're describing now, I think, is at a much lower frequency than that. For people at home to do this kind of work, the technology is kind of high, and I doubt it. The things that are going on right now at people's homes is flying these drones. And if you take a look at one of the most sophisticated drones I know of, let me drop it.
You mean they want the flamethrower on it?
That's one of the guys that's experimenting, and there's a guy that's also experimenting with a gun on board. But if you look at the data that's coming back, back these days from a brand name called DJI Phantom 3. What's unique about that particular drone, and it's a little bit pricey, I think the low-priced version starts off at a little under $700, and if you buy the super high-quality version, I think you can spend a couple of grand on this thing. But it's a super stabilized drone. It's got a beautiful flight system on board where even though you're flying it on a windy day and the drone is flopping around all kinds of ways, the camera is gimbaled with a very good key motion sensitive gimbaling system on the camera, and the camera is lock solid. So a buddy of mine who lives in my town, KC2YSK, owns one of the things, has taken lots and lots of flights with him over the last few months, and I've talked him into flying at a high enough altitude. He lives 2 miles from me, where I thought he'd be able to see my radio tower on the horizon. And the answer is so far, no. Let me drop this. And the reason for that is that when you buy the thing as is, it gives you a 2K image, 2,000 line image, which is a rather high resolution image. That's the good news. But the camera has got something like a 95-degree angle to it. It's a rather wide-angle lens. It really has to zoom in a little bit more than that in order to resolve my tower. My tower is only 18 inches wide, and so 2 miles away to see an object that's only a foot and a half wide is a very small fraction of a degree. Let me think now. 92 feet per mile is 1 degree. So we're talking about here roughly 1 minute of arc. In other words, resolving my tower from 2 miles away. A human eye can do that. This camera is not quite as high in resolution as a human eye because of the wide-angle lens. And I'm trying to talk Jay into putting a telephoto lens on that camera and properly balancing it. When you do a Google search, let me drop it. You do a Google search on movies done by DJI Phantom 3 owners, and there's a lot of owners in many countries around the world. One of those guys in the United States has put a telephoto lens on this thing, modified the lens that's there, and you get a lot higher resolution of what you're looking at. So those things are kind of fun. You can easily fly at 0 to 400 foot in altitude, and as you start looking at your neighborhood from 400 feet up, you get the image of what it would be like to be a private pilot flying over your neighborhood, which, by the way, the pilot wouldn't see as good an image. If you're following the FAA rules, you're not allowed to fly below 1,000 feet in altitude above the terrain in a residential area. You're allowed to go down to 500 feet in an uninhabited area, like a beachfront. So these drones give you a better picture than you would get flying over your neighborhood with a private pilot license. And lots and lots of people are jumping on this bandwagon. Right now, there's lots of news reports of the New York City airports starting to see an awful lot of drones in their flight paths. W2RYY for any comments. K2RYW in the tech net. By the way, some of these guys are all starting to put infrared cameras on these things. Over to you, Joe.
Listen, 1YDY.
Go ahead, Doug. All of a sudden, I've forgotten your name. What?
Hank.
Go ahead, Hank. Sorry about that.
Yeah, the rules just say 500 feet from any person, place, or thing.
At one time, I thought the rules are you're not allowed to fly below 1,000 feet when you're flying over a residential area. Over to you on that one, Hank.
Not residential, it's considered to be an inhabited area. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those two words, but that's just
Now, in the case of an ultralight, I know that the rules are a little bit more lax, but if you and I, with our private license, are flying over the center of Long Island, for instance, how low in altitude do you think I could go before I'd be violating FAA rules? Over to you, Hank.
It's 1,000 feet.
So, 1,000 feet flying over Long Island if I'm not in a landing pattern. And if I'm in a landing pattern, yes, you're flying over the house with the blue roof as you're on the final leg, so to speak. When I was landing at Coram Air Park, as it's called in those days,
aircraft in air now, let's try that again. When you are flying in an aircraft traffic pattern, you have to fly at an appropriate altitude for the leg you're going. So if you're going 800 feet, that's downwind, but as you turn final, obviously you can be lower if that's appropriate for landing.
UA2YBZ, comment.
YBZ, go right ahead. Start off with your name, person.
This is Peg. With a comment regarding drone flight. Let me drop. Current FAA regulations, people need to be very cautious about this, are not allowed to fly below, above 500 feet outside of your own property. So, in other words, a column of 500 feet high around your property. Let me drop. Or in specially designated areas, or if you have a special permit from the FAA for operations in other areas, for example, certain agencies like Fish and Wildlife might be given a special permit to fly in certain areas. So I really urge caution on this experimentation, because FAA is cracking down quite hard, and there have been a lot of violations and a lot of incidents and mishaps. That was just some input there. WA2YBZ.
I think this is Margaret that I'm talking to, and I believe you're talking about drones, and I think some of the drones are programmed in such a way they're not supposed to go above 400 feet in altitude. And I think you're saying that you only can fly a column directly above your property. You're not allowed to even leave the column above your property. Is that what you're saying, Margaret? To B2YBZ, K2LAW.
You can call me Peg, everybody does. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. That is current FAA regulations. Any questions or concerns or inquiries, definitely call the FAA directly, but that is as of today.
Okay, you said as of today. How recently was that officially announced? And to my knowledge, a high percentage of the people flying drones today are exceeding that column directly above your own property. So, how recent was that issued to your knowledge? Hey, go ahead.
Yes, this was just over the summer. There was two overhauls this year. FAA has been sort of scrambling because of the upsurge in drone operation and drone mishaps. And that's correct.
Out of curiosity, Peg, are you a private pilot or a commercial pilot?
Negative, but we work directly with an air wing, and we have several FAA certification managers on our team, one of whom we just happened to be consulting with yesterday on this very topic. So when I heard you discussing it, I just thought I would push that forward. Hopefully it will be helpful and urge some caution so that people can be safe in their operations and not end up getting in trouble. There will be more forthcoming.